Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It is a delight joining you at the end of the week. Here we are this delightful Friday, July 25th, 2014. Weather couldn't be better here on the East Coast in New York City. I hope the weather and all things in your world are going well, and I thank you for joining me. We will have a guest joining me shortly, a good friend, old friend of mine, Mark Hager, a history professor from North Carolina. I was in one of the documentaries that he was involved with several years ago about the Mexican border, and he has just returned shooting another documentary down there. He went all the way from Brownsville, Texas, which is the southernmost point on the U.S. map, all the way into Arizona. I was on the phone with Mark last night. The story that he told me was unbelievable. We have a very serious problem in this country, and the lack of leadership coming from both political parties is nothing short of astonishing. This country is allowing itself, in my humble opinion, to turn itself into a third world country. Lack of leadership, no moral guidance, no sense of purpose. I'd love to know what either political party could hold up as a mission statement, a destination, if you will, the flight plan where they plan to take this great nation. It's disgusting. And we're going to get to all of that, lots more. This is going to be a program that you're not going to want to stop listening to. And I hope that you will encourage your friends and neighbors, if you can't get them to listen live, to go to my website. Go to the radio or blog talk website and listen to the podcast of this program. There is so much going on. I feel as though that we're in the middle of a hurricane, a three-ring circus, and as I say, an absolute vacuum where leadership is concerned. In any event, those of you who are familiar with me know that I am a retired senior special agent of the former Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS, spent 30 years with that agency. Half of my career was spent with the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force and with an assignment to the Unified Intelligence Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration in New York City. I've been there, done it, seen it up close and in person, and if I thought it was ugly then, it's beyond belief today. You know, when I used to work for the old INS, I used to say initially that it was an agency in a state of free fall and that bottom was elusive. Over time, I came to the terrible conclusion that bottom was illusory. I am starting to almost feel that that's where we are with this nation of ours, and it's time that we, the people, stood up and got our voices heard. We have been lousy employers of our insubordinate politicians who work for us. Somehow the tail thinks it's wagging the dog, and we've allowed them to get away with it for far too long. This is not about left or right. This, folks, is about right or wrong. There's two websites I very much want you to go visit, but please wait till after the program. My own personal website, michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, one word, michaelcutler.net. More than likely, if you're listening to me, you know that website because there's a link to this program on my website. Also, I'm a writer for a terrific organization. Actually, they've given me the generous title of Senior Fellow, Californians for Population Stabilization. They are located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California, a great place to be, especially in the winter. But right now, I don't think their weather can beat ours out. I think we're probably equal in the weather department, but it's a delight to work for them or with them. And I've got a bunch of articles up on their website and the other writers who've also been writing for them. And before I bring my friend and a partner in crime, as I like to describe him, for all of our efforts to push back against the lunacy that we're witnessing, especially in Washington, you should know that for the longest time, CAPS, Californians Population Stabilization, their website, CAPSWeb, C-A-P-S, CAPSWeb.org, have been hammering this lack of security along the Mexican border, have been hammering the damage it's been doing to the wages of Americans, particularly America's minorities. And most recently, they've embarked on a radio campaign on the West Coast to educate as many Americans as possible about something that I've been asking for years, and that's very simply this. How in the world can we be accused of lacking compassion By ignoring our own citizens, our own children, charity begins at home. In fact, I wrote an article for them by that very title, I believe, about a year ago. And today, if you dare talk about the need to look after America's children first, you get vilified. Well, this flies in the face of common sense. It flies in the face of morality. And you think about catastrophes where a family member is trapped in a burning building or a car or a boat capsizes, and it's not unusual to see a family member, a parent, race into that dangerous situation to rescue their own child. Nobody in his or her right mind could possibly criticize that parent for looking after his child. That's called being responsible. Yet when we talk about taking care of America's poor first, all sorts of accusations fly. Earlier today I was watching Geraldo on Fox and Friends, and you could see that he was infuriating some of the other folks on the program, denying that American kids are living in poverty and how we need to bring in the folks from Latin America. I have to tell you, it was outrageous. Geraldo's got it sideways, but it's not unusual, unfortunately. Too many journalists for far too long have been getting it sideways. And just so you know, I'm writing an article for a terrific organization known as Progressives for Immigration Reform. Remember I said this isn't about left or right, but about right or wrong? And we're going to explore in an in-depth piece I'm working for them right now just how this propaganda machine has been feeding us a bunch of pablum or something that smells far worse. Well, with that having been said, welcome to the show, Mark Hager. Happy Friday. I hate to bring you on after that smelly comment.
Oh, that's okay.
How are you?
I'm glad to be
Mark.
On. Well, I've been busy. I just came back from meeting with our own sheriff's office here to go over details
for the edification of my listeners. You know, I always used to tell my daughter when she was a child that no matter where we went, we always wind up here. So it almost seemed like there was no reason to go anywhere because no matter where you are, we're always here. But for you, where is here?
That is Iredell County, North Carolina.
Okay. Beautiful part of the
which
country.
Which really on a map, it's where I-40 and 77 cross, a major
gotcha.
Drug corridor of illegal cross-border traffic coming right up our way and heading towards you.
Are you trying to tell me that you live on a border state, that it's North Carolina?
Yes.
I just couldn't resist, Mark.
That is correct, and we've had some recent busts here that directly tied back to our border that's as secure as it's ever been, according to some in Washington.
Like Harry Reid? Has anybody given
yes.
Harry Reid a mental exam lately?
Mm.
I think it's in
well,
order. What do you think?
I think it would be something that's needed, and he's just the first person. There's a whole lineup.
You know, when I think of Harry Reid, and I think of Harry Reid, you know, and then I start to think about an EEG, and the image that comes to mind are the wires strung across telephone poles. I suspect that's what Harry Reid's EEG looks like. What do you think?
It makes you wonder not just about him, but, you know, when we were little kids and being raised, you know, people would say, well, you can tell a lot about a person by the company that person keeps.
Oh, show me your friends. I'll tell you who you are. You betcha.
And so when you look at the current administration, and you just wonder if they ever
sure.
had any
Chuck
parental
Schumer.
Supervision.
Chuck Schumer, right? But tell
mm-hmm.
me, how much better is Lindsey Graham?
Not much.
So, I mean, here
not
we
much.
Go again. It's both sides of the aisle. I mean, the
mm-hmm.
eight gangsters, remember, it was 4-4, the eight gangsters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know.
They want to foist this nonsense on us that would absolutely destroy America. This isn't xenophobia.
Well,
you know, I want to make a point before we get to what you said, but
yeah.
I want everyone out there to understand this. They've been writing about it, and I want you guys to take notes because I suspect that most of you listening to the program are really as concerned as we are, and that's why I presume you're listening to my program, because very often, not always, but very often, my issue is immigration and border security, national security. How in the world do we allow people to get away with referring to those of us who want secure borders and effective immigration enforcement as being anti-immigrants? We are pro-enforcement. And here's something to remember, folks. When you have those debates with your neighbors, or when you confront politicians and they start making the accusations, here's what you really need to remind them. America's immigration laws are balanced. They not only tell us who to keep out and who to kick out, but who to admit. Every year we admit more than 1 million lawful immigrants into the United States. They have green cards. They're on the path to citizenship. Forget the lies that there's no other way to become a citizen. We naturalize more foreign nationals every year than the rest of the world. And, in fact, our immigration laws tell us what that process is. And last year, I believe the figure was in excess of 600,000 foreign nationals, resident aliens, were granted citizenship. We provide political asylum. We admit tens of millions of non-immigrant visitors, students, tourists, business people, and so forth, all under the aegis, under the provisions of the laws that we simply want to see effectively enforced and administered. This isn't about being anti-immigrant, because those laws provide for the admission of immigrants. This is the difference between being anti-immigrant, as they claim, and the reality that we are pro-enforcement. So when people tell you you're being anti-immigrant, stop them dead in their tracks and just make it very clear, this isn't about being anti-immigrant. This is about being pro-enforcement. I just had to make that point. Please make a note of it, folks. Write it down. It's really important. There is no arguing this point. And it's very effective when you go up against lying politicians, and all too often the term lying politicians is redundant. Not always. There are some real good guys out there and good gals. But for the most part, it's a redundancy in terminology. Anyway, I'm going to keep quiet so you can proceed. I just needed to make that point because I'm just so infuriated by everything I'm reading in the press, listening to TV. I was listening to Geraldo this morning, and I got to tell you, it's a good thing I don't have high blood pressure because I probably would have had a stroke this morning.
Well, I understand that, and I haven't been able to catch very much of the news today. I did hear some chatter about the possibility that the president may sign some sort of executive order to just start flying people up from Honduras.
Believe it or not, yes. And, in fact, I was talking to one of the producers over at Fox, and they said that if it happened, they might want me to stop by the studio and provide perspective. We'll see what happens. But, again, he's got a pen, he's got a phone, and what is he talking about? That maybe the solution to all these kids coming here illegally, you're not going to believe this, Mark, and you folks out there, if you haven't heard this, put on your seatbelt and assume the brace position, because here it comes. He wants to have these kids interviewed in Honduras to determine if they have a valid claim to political asylum, and if so, to simply fly them here so that they can bypass the coyotes. The U.S. government is now competing with alien smugglers. You know, I'm a very big fan. Well, there's no other way of describing it. De Blasio, Bloomberg's successor, who proved that my dad was right, nothing is so good it couldn't get better or be so bad it couldn't get worse. We've certainly gone from bad to horrendous in New York. He's competing with people that sell phony documents to illegal aliens because he's now getting the city of New York to give illegal aliens identity documents. Never mind they can't verify their identity. And by the way, even the banks are screaming bloody murder because he wants banks to accept the ID as valid. I mean, this is insanity on a galactic scale. But,
you know,
think about what the president is talking about. You know, I'm a big fan of political asylum. I was named for my grandmother who was killed in the Holocaust. Back when I was in high school and college, I participated in demonstrations as a B'nai B'rith president in Washington, asking then-President Lyndon Johnson to convince the Russians to let Jews and other minorities leave Russia, come to the United States or other countries that would have them. For me, it was a privilege. It was an exciting day when I got to admit refugees into the United States because, you know, you got to see this look on these people's faces. We literally had people come through the doors at the International Arrivals Building at Kennedy Airport and kiss the floor, run up and hug me. They were crying. They were laughing. I mean, the spectrum of human emotion was unbelievable, and that system had integrity. It's estimated that today 70% of the applications for asylum are fraud. The people are lying. In 1993, a guy by the name of Amil Kansi shot up the CIA. He was a Pakistani national. He applied for asylum, lied through his teeth, repaid our kindness by killing two CIA officers, wounding three others, and then availed himself of something that only foreign nationals can do. They have an escape hatch they can escape through, and that's by leaving our border, by running back to their home country, except in Kansi's case, our military found him, you know, brought him back here, put him on trial. He was executed upon being convicted, but the dead remain dead. And then 1 month later, Ramzi Youssef, one of the participants in the Trade Center bombing of 93, six dead, over 1,000 injured. The buildings almost came down sideways. They did a $500 million with a B, $500 million in damage. Ramzi Youssef was one of the key players. He had been granted political asylum. Then you have the Boston bombing last year up in Massachusetts. Guess what? The Tsarnaev family apparently lied on their application for asylum. And then not long ago, I was with Fox and Friends in the morning on Saturday, and the discussion was how the president said, well, you know, right now the law says that if you have any contact with terrorist organizations, you're barred from political asylum. That's not fair. You can have incidental contact, minor contact with terrorists. We'll still give you asylum. God only knows what he considers minor or incidental contact. So, you know, and before that we had a 70% fraud rate, and the 9/11 Commission made it clear that fraud in the immigration program and visa programs, especially asylum, were a method of choice for terrorists to enter the country and embed themselves. And what frustrated me the most is that on 9/11, when those ashes landed on my home and my neighbors died and my neighbors were out screaming, the ones who survived, I knew that 4.5 years earlier, May 20th, 1997, I testified at a congressional hearing about visa fraud, immigration benefit fraud. So now we've got the president saying, let's bring these kids in. First of all, asylum means that because of race, religion, ethnicity, political orientation, that sort of thing, you're facing persecution. Well, now we're changing it, apparently. Now you can claim that you live in a violent country. So any country that has a crime rate, I guess, is eligible for asylum. And when the kids get here, you know what the next thing they're going to say is, well, we can't have these kids without their families, so let's bring Mama Bear, Papa Bear, and all the sibling bears to the United States. So we're going to see chain migration on steroids without even consideration to what the law requires. And why are we limiting it to Honduras? I mean, why don't we include Guatemala? Why don't we include Colombia and Bolivia? While we're at it, how about the Dominican Republic and Jamaica? And then we can, of course, go over to Asia and find more countries with high crime rates. This is absolutely a dismantling of the borders of the United States, willfully done by our own government that took an oath to uphold the Constitution and protect America and Americans. How in the world can you do that with an open border? Forgive me for the long rant, Mark, but my head has been exploding all day ever since I heard this proposal.
Well, I know. We spent 9 days.
And you were down there. What did you see? What were your observations? Yeah. What are your thoughts? That's really what I want to get into tonight.
Well, we started from down south of McAllen and then worked our way all the way up the border through
Texas,
Arizona. And, of course, the sheriff's office we were with and some of the Border Patrol that we came in contact with, you know, we saw multiple groups coming across from the Rio Grande and getting apprehended, and this group of 70 in one, and group that our camera guy was with, I mean, not a group, he wasn't in, with a group crossing the Rio Grande, but sheriff deputy coming in the other way with them. But
yeah.
Filming with the sheriff deputy, it was a group of 20, and there was about seven in another group, and it was just ongoing. Of course, we saw all the jet skis going back and forth, and of course, I guess after we left, they got upset, and that was when they started firing that 50 caliber at Border Patrol.
Who was firing?
Sometime after that. From some cartel operative on the other side of the Rio Grande.
And this
Border
was
Patrol.
Down, and what part was this, in Texas or Arizona, or where was this?
In Texas, down towards McAllen.
So in other words, you weren't far from Brownsville. So if you envision a map of the United States, this is like directly across from Florida on the opposite side of the Gulf of Mexico, the southernmost tip of the United States, right where Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico, and the United States all intersect. Is that roughly where you were?
Yes, and a lot of filming that we did there. But we didn't. One of the things that surprised us in that area was that we didn't see any kids. And, of course, the way the news media covers it, it's that all these kids are coming over left and right, and it's a humanitarian crisis. How to, we got to give them diapers and formula, and we were surprised not to see any. And we were told by law enforcement down there that the number of kids coming over is probably around 6% of the actual number
6%.
That they catch, and about 6%
wow.
of the 30% that they actually apprehend. The rest of them, there's just simply not enough resources to cover.
So the sheriffs arrest illegal aliens, or at least they're detaining them. But legally,
yes,
it's up to the Border Patrol to then take custody. Is the Border Patrol responding
right.
to the sheriffs?
In that part of Texas, I guess it's just they're so overwhelmed that they're trying to do what they can and help each other out as much as possible. And the Border Patrol was actually quite open and quite talkative with us, which the farther – and to me, my understanding is that the reason that's happening is that, you know, the guys on the ground are not the ones in Washington. And the ones
right.
on the ground are trying to figure out the mess themselves and the day-in and day-out battle that they're having to go through. They're much more willing to talk.
Well, you know, there's been reports about how the administration is threatening to prosecute, not just fire, but prosecute anybody who shares any official documents that are marked law enforcement sensitive, for example.
Oh, I know that. Well, of course, we told them, the Border Patrol right up front, you know, we would not put their faces on the camera.
Yeah,
so,
but this goes to a point that's very important that I want everyone out there to understand that. I'm going to be on a radio program tomorrow with my friend Neil Young up in the New England area. And he said, well, you know, these darn bureaucrats, and I heard this earlier today from my friend Bobby Walsh, and I was on his show this morning, and I love doing Bobby's show. In fact, I'm going to be with him next Friday. Now, one of the common beliefs that a lot of people have, really we need to clarify this, oh, it's the fault of the government workers. Most grunts, most government workers at the field level, senior special agents, Border Patrol agents, adjudications officers, they understand the danger that we are being subjected to because of these failures to secure the borders and effectively enforce the law. The people that we should really be angry with are the folks who are the appointees or the ones at the very least who are in upper levels of management. These are the ones who are going along to get along. But I can tell you from my own experience, field agents are angrier than anybody you will ever meet because they really get the point. They really understand how dangerous this situation is. So I think you're finding that what you saw squares with what I'm describing. So I want you folks out there to be sympathetic to the agents, be sympathetic to the civil servant unions. They have nothing to do with politics under the Hatch Act. They're prohibited. But they are the ones that are able to get information out of what was touted as the most transparent administration, this side of a brick wall, perhaps?
Yes, and I think that what we saw down there was evident that the Gulf cartel is the major cartel that is spreading the propaganda and pushing these people across the border because it lines right up with their corridor.
The obvious question then: did you see drugs being seized by law enforcement when they were finding these illegal aliens?
Well, you see, that's one of the crazy questions. Because if you say no, then they say there's not drugs. But what we saw is that the coyotes are treating the people as drugs because they know the catch and release policy.
Yeah.
That if they inundate America with a large number of illegal aliens, will release them right as many as possible back across, and then they then have to pay again to come back across. So it's like you have each person is a
an ATM.
Piece of cocaine.
Yeah, it's an ATM.
Yeah. that goes back and forth.
But here's the other thing that people should realize. So you're saying you didn't see much in the way of drugs being seized by the people they were grabbing, correct?
Now, see, this. Okay. No, that's only one part. That's the lower. That's the first part of the border. Once you go farther up, then it is drugs. But right there where the human element is, it's the people are being treated as drugs, and they're treating them
terribly. Oh, they are.
And
look, smugglers are smugglers. To them, contraband could be a person, contraband could be a suitcase filled with drugs, or contraband could be a dirty weapon. It's just
they
cargo.
They really don't care.
It's human cargo.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm also
thinking...
They don't
care about their people, or...
No. Look, I was part of the first anti-smuggling unit in New York. We actually had a horrible case where some guy died in the back of a van being driven all the way to New York, and the guy dies. And he was from Central America. I don't recall which country. This was, goodness, in the late 70s, so we're talking many years ago. But the family gets a phone call. Picture the phone call. And they said, we got your uncle, you know, Pedro, whatever. If you want to see him, you'll give us another $5,000, which they did. And the next morning, they found Pedro's dead body on their front lawn. They had dropped him there during the night, apparently. Can you picture that? So understand you're dealing with some of the vilest, most sociopathic individuals in the world. They're right up there with terrorists. They don't care about human life. They don't care about anything except profits and what motivates them personally. Other than that, they don't care about children. There were rape trees. I don't know if you saw the rape trees, but women that know that they're going to subject themselves to the smugglers know that the likelihood is great that they're going to be raped, and they're actually encouraged to start taking birth control pills, believe it or not, 3 to 4 months before making the journey so that they don't become pregnant. This is how rampant the violence, how pervasive it is. They are pawns in this game, the smuggled aliens. We as Americans are pawns in this game as well. And my thought is that perhaps the people that you saw coming in that were apprehended made it easy for them to be apprehended so that other people with the drugs could get past the Border Patrol while they were bogged down dealing with this load of illegal aliens who had no drugs.
Well, that's exactly what we were hearing, was that while Perry and Governor Perry and the DPS were all inundating to try to handle
the public safety
issue.
DPS, correct?
Right. Yes, okay. In the lower Rio Grande Valley, that at that point, then drug operations were coming over much easier. And that's one of the things that we're picking up on here in the interior. I mean, even here in North Carolina, that there seems to be some visible movement of more drugs taking place. And my bet is that it's the other drug cartels. Of course, the Sinaloa, we found, it is growing really huge. It is now working south of Del Rio, Texas. So it's covering an area from California down through Del Rio, Texas. And the Juarez cartel is trying to fight over a little bit of that territory around Del Rio. And Borrelias Zacas is the new... is their new militant arm that's working out of the El Paso area. And some of the accounts there, they make MS-13 look kind of tame. And the drug...
But look what's happening now, Mark. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but look what's happening. Police departments across the country, even New York City, are giving the antidote to heroin overdoses to their officers because we are witnessing the worst heroin epidemic in the history of the United States. Heroin is as cheap as sand. There's a caller from area code 254. Let me just take a brief call, and we'll get back to this. I just want to see who we have and if that's okay with you.
Okay.
Okay, caller. You're on with Michael Cutler and Mark Hager.
Michael, this is Christina Jeffrey.
Christina Jeffrey, my goodness. Professor Jeffrey, how are you?
I am fine. I am in Texas, and on Saturday I watched the convoys going down to I think they were going to Fort Hood to get organized, and from there they were going, this is the National Guard, they were going to the border. And the reaction of some of my friends in South Carolina, and also there's a border guard who is saying this kind of thing, and a sheriff along the border, They are poo-pooing the National Guard. They're saying they're not overwhelmed. There's nothing that these untrained people can do. And my friends are buying it. They're saying, well, you know, maybe we need to guard our county borders. I'd like to know what your guest thinks.
Well, I dealt with sheriffs from one end to the other, and I would say that around Hidalgo County, that, you know, their sheriff that was there was indicted on several charges to where he may have been involved with money laundering with things such as the cartels, and so they're trying to recover from that. So
he doesn't count.
Tended to be, right, so they tended to be less, I guess, right out front with us about what they're feeling and their impact because of that part. But the rest of the sheriffs out there, the National Guard, they can't arrest.
Well, there's talk now about Perry giving them the authority to make arrests, and I wonder how the mechanics of that's going to play out, because at the end of the day, they still have to go before an immigration judge, and there's a shortage of judges.
Well, the common thing that I heard from the sheriff's office is that if they were just given the necessary resources and the Border Patrol teams allowed to actually do their jobs and deploy them actually on the border, not 20 to 30 miles inland, which is all the way across the border, they're set up in that way, that the National Guard isn't so necessary. And if you do send the National Guard, they have come down before in the past, and they're kind of a support where they push papers. I know one sheriff in Arizona told me that he did like the National Guard being there because at least for a little while, that if you're over in Mexico, they didn't know what was going on. So it would
right.
at least pause them until they realize the National Guard's unarmed and it's not going to be doing anything of any real consequence, and then it kind of works against them. But
well, here's
until
the thought,
they
though,
actually
Mark.
Put, yeah.
Well, so here's the thing, though. Are they still dealing with large numbers of illegal aliens coming across where the Border Patrol is being forced into concierge service? Because one of the things I had suggested when there was a hearing about this was that they should have the guard on the border, at the very least, to free up Border Patrol agents so that they don't wind up doing concierge service for the illegals that are in custody, especially the unaccompanied minors. Although, from what you're telling me, the numbers are probably far lower than they're claiming they are in terms of unaccompanied minors.
I did not see. I mean, but then again, a 13-year-old minor, as one sheriff's officer was showing me some pictures of, that had been apprehended before we got there, had already been involved with with torture and a rape incident in his county. And was a member of
a 13-year-old.
He said a 13-year-old, you know, that they're dealing with coming out of South America is far different than a 13-year-old growing up in some little town outside of New York or wherever.
Gang members and so forth.
Yeah, it's a whole different world on that side to this side. So, and even by the president, you know, with the DREAM Act, you know, a 30-year-old can be considered a child.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So when you look at what they, you know, see coming over and what we witnessed coming over, we just did not see any infants. Teenagers, yes, some of them were possible. And we saw many OTMs, including one young lady that, you know, if we didn't arrive there, she probably would not have made it. She was at the final end of heat exhaustion, where the drug coyotes basically left her for nothing because she was lagging too far behind, and that was in DeMint County, Texas.
What's an OTM?
Other than Mexican.
Oh,
she was from Honduras.
Thanks.
She was actually from Honduras.
I'll tell you what it sounds like to me. It sounds to me as though some of our good Border Patrol guys and sheriffs want to be sure that for PR purposes and to survive their elections or whatever they have to do to keep their jobs, they don't want to be blamed for this. And so they say, if the Border Patrol was allowed to do its job, if the sheriffs, if the National Guard had more resources, if the sheriffs, but that's a whole lot of hypotheticals. Perry can't control everything. It seems to me that he was answering Mike Cutler's call and doing what he could do. And if it scared the Mexican bad guys for a little while, at least it did something. And it also,
yeah.
it also is a, I think it encourages other governors to exercise their authority as governors. I mean, this is a federal system. They do have some authority. If they had as much willingness to use every bit of possible authority, I'd like them not to go beyond it, but the president certainly goes beyond his authority. He certainly doesn't stand 30 miles back from the constitutional line. He rushes right across it. So I'd like to see a little more manliness from our governors.
Well, I'll tell you what the problem is, though, Christine, and this is an interesting article that was published on July 21st, just a couple days ago, National Review Online, Obama gives ICE the cold shoulder, a little twist of words. But the point here is that the Border Patrol is being basically told to sit down and do nothing, and I could see that happening. And if that's
it looks to me like that's happening.
Absolutely,
well,
and they're being warned that if they dare talk to anybody about it, that they'll be either, at the very least, fired and possibly criminally prosecuted, if you could imagine that.
The governors have to do what they can do.
Well, let me just read this one quote, and this comes from a former Border Patrol guy. He said they're still sitting at their desks reading newspapers, playing video games on their government computers because they're not being tasked with work and they feel that it's coming all the way down from the top, Colburn tells NRO. These are guys who want to go out and do more, but basically they're not. He said that some ICE agents go to work out in the gym for 4 hours each day because they have little work to do. Meanwhile, the Obama administration continues to strangle them with Border Patrol agents who must handle the latest flow of Central Americans rather than being on the border. And this goes to my point that they're being told, no, don't go out on the line. Just take care of these people that are here, and when you get done with them, just sit at your desk. So when they get done with the paperwork, rather than going back out on the line, they're stuck in the office. So what do you do with a situation like that? And they want to be out there. Believe me, they want to be out there desperately because they understand the danger here.
Well, I know from my brief experience in Washington, D.C., that when Democrats don't like what an administration is doing, they are giving special order speeches every day after session. They are doing 1 minute every morning before session. They are raising absolute cane. And yes, there's limited conservative media, but I don't think it's concentrating on this the way it could be.
Oh, I agree with you, and that's why I cover it on this program, and I'm happy to go on other shows willing to take this on the way it needs to be. But look, it's not left or right.
We need a lot more of you.
Well, thank you, Chris.
We have elected officials, and, you know, people criticize the Tea Party, but from my observation, the congressmen in Texas got themselves to the border after the Tea Party's rallied.
But don't you understand, both parties hate the Tea Party because it's making them accountable.
Making them do work.
Yeah, and making them fess up. Because
Congress could make the Border Patrol do work, too.
But they're happy with the status quo, I believe, because look, we got the first amnesty from Mr. Reagan.
Congress is happy with the status quo.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. No,
they
want
labor for the people making the campaign contributions.
Yeah, I know.
They win. Let me tell you my take, and you tell me what you think. You know, Christina ran for Congress. She's a great friend, and she's a great American, and we have great spirited conversations all the time. And so here's my question. Isn't this a win-win for the Republicans, really? They have the opportunity to go out and beat up on the president, who's not popular with anybody, understandably so. So they get to complain and talk about how lousy the administration is. They get to scream about how terrible the situation is. But meanwhile, every single day, more illegal aliens are coming in. Every single day, the people making the campaign contributions, and it's not just the bottom rung, by the way. We're talking about Silicon Valley that want more H-1B visas and so forth. So this lack of enforcement, this lack of integrity to the visa process and so forth is benefiting the people who want the current state of anarchy, if you will. And the Republicans get to have their cake and eat it too. They get to scream like crazy.
Well, Cantor lost his job because of this, because of his position on amnesty. And Washington may not realize it, but most people can connect the dots between amnesty and the and what's going on in the border. It's not
rocket
science.
But what do you think it
might
take, though, for the average politician?
The average politician deserves to lose in November. I hope he does.
Don't you think they're happy with this? Even the average Republican, I don't think they're as upset as they want the public to believe, and they better learn otherwise.
I really don't. I mean, I think that Alan Keyes is correct that we should be talking about impeachment. They should be talking about impeachment. You know, there's three branches of government. Congress doesn't need to go and beg the judiciary to make the president do his job. Congress has their own way of dealing with the president if he doesn't do his job.
So why aren't they?
They are propagandizing Republicans into believing that, oh, well, you remember that we tried that in 1995? Where was it? Was it 1996? Sure enough, in 1998, we lost the Senate, so we can't be doing that. That's a dangerous thing to do. But if people go back and look at their history, what Bill Clinton did was what they charged Bill Clinton with doing. I think they had 300 things they could have charged him with, but they think the American people are too stupid to deal with 300 things, so they concentrated only on sex. They figured the American people could handle that. And the American people just shrugged, and it wasn't well done at all.
No.
So it was a very different time, very different president, very different attitude. I think you are completely correct. They're not unhappy with hundreds of thousands of people coming here illegally. They're not unhappy with 12 million illegal aliens. Everything's hunky-dory as far as they're concerned, and they don't want to do anything. But
I think Keyes is right. The way
to make them do something is to have a real grassroots swelling of demand for impeachment.
Well, that's why down on the border the frustration is so great, to where that when you were talking about the sheriffs earlier, each office that we went into, they are not sitting around. They are trying to do what they can with limited resources to try to help their counties, and the sheriffs are working around the clock to try to do what they can and what the county expects them to do. But when you're in a county with 950 residents that has to cover 2,300 square miles, such as Terrell County, that tax base only supports six deputies, and there's virtually no other enforcement there. And then they do apprehend and then have to medically treat, and that comes at the taxpayer cost of that county, and they're not being reimbursed. It is so not right.
And surely the National Guard could be of service to the sheriffs. They have law enforcement-type training.
That's what I agree. If you're going to send the National Guard down there to where the deputies and other enforcement that works with the sheriff's offices, they know the residents, they know the county, they know where to go. So if they can be the motor pool and keep the vehicles running and give them the logistics and then so they can get to A to B to C, and then give them more boots on the ground that can actually do something on the border, then that would be a huge success. But to just come down there and be unarmed, and you said, Mike, that Perry is going to give the National Guard arresting authority.
That's what they were talking about. By the way, just for the sake of those of my audience who are joining a little bit late, we have two professors with us today. Professor Mark Hager teaches history at what's your school, Mark?
At Lenoir Ryan University.
I'm sorry?
At Lenoir Ryan University in North Carolina.
Oh, that's a fine school. Very close to where I teach at Wofford College.
Oh, okay.
Howdy, neighbor.
Yes.
Christina, meet Mark. Mark, meet Christina. Mm-hmm. It's great having these two intellectual giants with me this evening. Seriously, when you look at this from any perspective, and Christina had been a candidate for the Congress, and I consider both of you to be good friends. It's a privilege to join you on a Friday evening like this. It's just nuts that the American people are being basically shafted by their own government from both political parties, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is really, really shocking. It is really, really shocking.
And history
will not be kind to our leaders.
I mean, have you ever seen a comparable period in recent history where there's been such a vacuum of leadership, morality, and vision?
No, I think we've been slouching towards Gomorrah for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
The final end of the Roman Empire was quite similar.
That's exactly what I posted. I think I put it on Twitter, and I had more responses to that than anything I've ever said on social media.
I think we're resonating with the people. You know, I was just working on a piece for Progressives for Immigration Reform. See, it's not about being progressive or not. I know that the conservatives get crazy when they use the word progressive. But, you know, if you look at Barbara Jordan, who was a super liberal member of Congress, she would have agreed with us issue by issue on immigration. But I was writing a piece about asymmetrical warfare and how terrorists look at America's borders as getting behind the enemy lines, because our borders are the enemy lines to terrorists. And just as I was penning those words, or typing those words, if you will, asymmetrical warfare, I saw your email about Mexico and asymmetrical warfare, Christina. So I thought, wow, we're really on the same frequency this evening, and now here you are on the program with me, by surprise, a pleasant surprise, I might add.
Well,
I mean,
I didn't know about your article. My mouth is sort of hanging open here right now, and I'm thinking, first person I heard use that term was Michael Opus. Is Michael in touch with Mike Cutler? If not, I need to get them together.
Well, I've been using the term asymmetrical warfare for a long time because, you know, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And, in fact, I wrote an article quite some time ago, and I'm probably going to include it. And I believe the guy's name was John Deitch, who was arrested by the FBI. It's a big article on the FBI website about the saboteurs who were going to destroy America from the inside during the Second World War. Interesting footnote in history, and you guys are history people, so this is interesting. One of the submarines, one of the U-boats, they weren't really submarines, they were U-boats, underwater boats that they had fielded back during the Second World War, they, the Germans, their goal was to get beneath Grand Central Station in New York, and I didn't know what the target had been by the other articles. You may not know this, but six levels below that main concourse at Grand Central Station, and they always like to use Grand Central as a backdrop for films, and I think David Letterman sometimes uses it on his program, people walking through this big expanse of Grand Central Station. Six layers down is a facility that converts AC to DC power that powers the trains. And during the Second World War, the Nazis had figured it out that if they could take out that facility that provides power to the trains, if they could cut the electricity to the trains by blowing up that facility six or ten levels down, it would shut off all the trains that were delivering so much war material to the East Coast for shipment to England. So at the end of the day, whether it's infiltration by terrorists or saboteurs or depending on the era and the jargon we use, at the end of the day, an act of terrorism, and Mark and I discussed this a day or two ago, it may be a nation that's attacked, but at the end of the day, just like Tip O'Neill said that all politics is local, all terrorism is local. Ultimately, the Trade Center came down on West Broadway, on West Street. So when you consider it that way, terror attacks impact neighborhoods as much as our country. My hometown was devastated on 9/11. We as Americans need to understand this existential risk to all of us. As I said during one of my hearings, no American city is safe if any American city is attacked. We are leaving ourselves wide open, God forbid, for the next attack. We see ISIS making steady advancement in Iraq, where the Christians are being eradicated. Basically, it's ethnic cleansing right now, or religious cleansing going on in parts of Iraq. We know ISIS has the United States at its crosshairs. ISIS is being portrayed as even crazier than Al-Qaeda. And is this the time to be leaving our doors and windows open and so forth? Have I lost my mind, guys?
No.
What I like about you, Mike, is you have constantly, constantly connected the dots, both locally and internationally. I mean, to some people, the crisis at the border is, well, it's just a problem for South Texas and New Mexico, Arizona.
And, you know, as I like to tell people, when people run our border, of course, the illegals and the terrorists and so forth come in through international airports. They can come in through seaports. We're a country of 50 states. But nobody runs the U.S. border the way that Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin went to the moon. I mean, they're not running up to the border, hopping over the border, planting their boot prints on the ground, grabbing a flag, shoving the flag into the ground, grabbing rocks and going home. That's not how they're coming. The goal is to get to the rest of the country. We have a huge illegal Mexican population in New York City. We have a huge illegal Central American population in New York City. I spent many years arresting people from those countries who had run the border, got on buses or vans or airplanes, and one way or the other made their way to New York from the Mexican border. You know, so this notion that this is only an issue for four border states, and that was why I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine that I referred to as Border Security and the Immigration Colander. We're being fed this pablum, or more smelly stuff, if you will, forgive me, that if we could just sort of kind of secure the Mexican border part of the time in certain ways, then all the other failures of the immigration system don't matter. And my analogy, because I like using analogies, as you know, is that this is like telling people that if you partially plug a hole in the bottom of a colander, you can now use that colander as a bucket to carry water. Anybody making that proposal would be laughed at.
That's a good one.
But doesn't that paint a clear picture, Christina? I hear you chuckling, so I guess I've succeeded.
Yes. That's a wonderful picture. I don't want to change the subject, but
sure.
You raised a question about you dangled some incomplete information about a border guard named Zach that you had some questions about, and I'm going to be talking with the people who were impressed with his interview. I don't know if you want to use his name, but maybe you can tell me what the problem is with
we'll have that conversation, but I'm not going to do it right now.
Okay.
Now, and in fact, I have to go and work on some questions with our documentary that's coming out from this. I was supposed to be talking about that about 20 minutes ago. I mean, off this call and such.
Oh,
but it was a lively call. But, you know, the last thing that we've learned is that, you know, the drug cartel networks are enlarging. Ironically, the only place that was kind of quiet was the area around Del Rio, and the only reason why that was quiet is because there's potentially 2 to 3 drug cartels fighting it out on the other side to get control of that corridor. So the sheriff's there is nervous because he knows as soon as that is finished, then it's going to be wide open again in his area. But, you know, the people that we talked to, eyewitnesses, people that have been directly affected, some of them beaten. One woman about had her head crushed in Arizona who survived. She is going to be in the documentary talking, and again, you know, these sheriffs come from Democrat and Republican sides, as well as residents that we talked to, male and female and alike, that the basic mindset to people in America is that, you know, they're coming over them and they're heading to anywhere USA, and what's coming through, by and large, at least outside of DeMint County and up, are people that you do not want to have in your neighborhoods.
And, you know, that's the point, Mark, just to interrupt just for one second, but that's the point I want people to think about. I write about this frequently. If you go to Title 8, United States Code Section 1182, it's the categories of excludable aliens, if you listen to the media, you would think this is about race. There is absolutely nothing about race in the law. It is about the categories of aliens who are to be kept out. Aliens with dangerous communicable diseases and serious mental illness. Think about it. Ellis Island was a quarantine station run as much by public health as by immigration. Aliens who are convicted felons or prior deportees, and generally we deport people because of serious criminal histories. So you're talking about murderers, rapists, gang members, drug traffickers, human traffickers, gun runners, money launderers, that sort of thing. aliens who espies terrorists, human rights violators, and war criminals. And then we get to aliens who would likely become a public charge or by working who would take the jobs or provide unfair competition with American workers and at the very least drive down wages and working conditions. Who in the world could possibly complain about enforcing those laws? Who in the world would want to live next to aliens who are war criminals, were seriously mentally ill, suffered dangerous communicable diseases, or were violent or sociopathic? That's what the laws are about. And yet when you dare talk about it, the accusations flow. And the lunacy behind this is that you had a mayor in New York by the name of Bloomberg who went out there and held innumerable press conferences, screamed bloody murder that the prosecutors in the Bronx weren't prosecuting people who trespass into public housing, saying, well, if you let people in who sneak in, you're going to bring back crime. People want to know who they are and why they're here. This is the same mayor who, in another breath, the same day, may well have held a news conference talking about the need to provide lawful status to people who trespass on America. If you understand
that... Well, he's out of the country right now. Can we exclude him for mental illness?
I wish we could, but he's an American citizen, and that's the other thing people need to understand, because I get this all the time. Well, we're splitting up families. They've had children here. Well, if you're born in America or you're a United States citizen, we could have the conversation about the 14th Amendment. We'll reserve that, because right now, if you're born in the United States, you're a citizen unless you were born to parents who are diplomats. A child born to illegal aliens is an American and can play hopscotch with the U.S. border 53 times a day. We make no effort to prevent Americans from ever entering the country. In fact, at the Academy, we made a distinction. Aliens seeking entry are inspected. Citizens are examined. It may sound like, you know, a trivial point, but the reason that they use the two different terms, examination versus inspection, is because once you're satisfied that the person standing in front of you as an inspector is a citizen, under no circumstances may you deny that person entry into the United States. You may hold them because you know that the FBI or the local homicide detectives want them for a crime. That you can do. But you cannot bar them from entering. And that's, again, one of the things you never hear about. So we hear all these lies, all these half-truths, all these accusations. This is such a serious threat to America and Americans, folks. Unlike the Jack Nicholson line in A Few Good Men, I insist that you have the truth. What do you think?
Well, that's really good. And again, because I got to go work on the documentary thing, but I just hope people wake up and start to look around and really feel that. I think most Americans, they at least got to pause and say something's not right.
Mark, when can we see it?
We're hoping that this will be done by September. It could be by the end of August. And it looks as if it'll be at least 60 minutes long, and even that, it will be intense all the way through it. There's not going to be any fluff of any type through it. And so I can't wait for it to come out.
I hope you're able to get. I hope we're able to make arrangements so I can at least shoot a segment for you. Let me know how that goes, by the way, Mark.
Okay, I sure will. But thank you for having me on, and we'll talk again real soon.
Oh, absolutely.
God bless.
Is there a website affiliated with your film, by the way?
The website, we want to build one under our group that we've kind of placed together. It's called the American Security Coalition. And so we want to build a website around it. And then if not, it will be available. I just don't know which websites, but there will be a number of it. I know through Tea Party Patriots, we'll be showcasing it quite heavily.
Awesome.
And that's teapartypatriots.org.
Well, I got to tell you, Mark, I'm certainly proud to consider you a friend and to work with you on these issues. As I say, I hope that I'll be able to ultimately sit down because there was a scheduling problem for next week. But I want you to know how much I appreciate all the hard work you're doing. I want to get you back soon to talk about the film as it progresses and your
all
thoughts
right.
as you put everything together.
Well, I sure will, and I enjoyed listening to professors talk. So
Not half as much as I did. Christina, you can stay with us for a couple of minutes
if
we go a little bit long.
But
Mark
you all
Hager,
take care
I wish
and
you and
safe.
Your family a wonderful weekend.
Okay, you too.
Okay,
bye.
Take care. So, Christina, you're in Texas now. What are you up to? What mischief are you creating this evening, if I might ask? Christina?
Can you hear me?
I hear you now. I feel like we're doing that cell phone
commercial. Okay, good. I'm actually just swimming and reading and getting some R&R. I was involved a lot with politics in the fall and the spring, and so I'm going to concentrate on my academics this coming year. I don't think anybody that I supported got nominated.
you're not looking to run again?
No. It's not prudent to say you'll never do something, but
okay.
I don't have any plans to run at the moment.
Well, we can use a smart gal like you who has a strong moral compass and a great understanding of the issues.
Well, I thank you for that, but we have to convince a lot of other people, and they're not so easily convinced. And besides, you know, my congressman is doing a pretty good job. Certainly rhetorically, he's out on the front line, and that's Trey Gowdy.
Yep. No, I think he does do an excellent job. I think he's a little bit distracted from the immigration issue with the Benghazi hearings, the Benghazi Select Committee, that is to say. But he is.
I mean, so many of our problems really come down to the same thing, and that is an administration that doesn't follow the rule of law.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And
I think the
secondary issue is one of federalism. Has no respect for the fact that he doesn't have all of the authority at the national level, and the national level doesn't have all the authority in the country. I mean, we have powers very diffused in our system, and he does not recognize that.
Well, I think he has aspirations I remember when I was a kid, they used to have imperial margarine where people wore little crowns. Maybe we could find one of those crowns and mail it to the White House. What do you think?
Yeah, there ought to be a cartoon that depicts our leader that way. It would be appropriate, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it? And you know, somebody said that he's actually the president that Nixon wanted to be. And I remember when Nixon was president, do you recall that he had gone to Europe and was so impressed with the uniforms that the Palace Guard, and I forgot which country it was in, wore, that he insisted that the White House protective detail for the Secret Service, the uniform division, wore similar uniforms. I think it lasted about 3 weeks, and then those uniforms went where they should have gone in the first place, to the marching band of some high school somewhere.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
It actually happened. You can look it up.
Well,
the man who would be king. I thought Michael Caine and Sean Connery were wonderful in it, but I don't think Obama is. What do you think of that?
No, it's a bad casting.
Bad casting. The man who would be king.
I want a do-over.
You and me, but I think there's a lot of Americans who want a do-over.
A lot of Americans want a do-over, and the attitude in Washington is just shrugging. You know, the money keeps flowing. They think their jobs are secure. So why?
Well, but, you know, Mr. Cantor thought his job was secure also. And to be very blunt with you, I had some wonderful conversations with Dave Brat prior to the election. I think if people really understood immigration for what it is, there'd be no way on God's green earth that you could run successfully for dog catcher, let alone for a member of Congress's seat, by advocating for not securing our borders and not enforcing our laws. Those borders and our laws are our first and last line of defense against international terrorists and transnational criminals. We built the American middle class.
Mr. Obama didn't have claims to African American ancestry, which of course he doesn't have any claim to African American ancestry, but he's been claimed by that 13% of our society. But if he were a white man doing this, Shirley Jackson Lee would be even noisier than she is, and the entire NAACP would be raising Cain. This is the schools these kids are going to land in are going to be majority black schools, and they're going to be overwhelmed.
And what I don't understand is
getting that good an education right now. The last thing these kids need is for a lot of the attention to go to bilingual education when they're struggling to get good reading teachers for American children.
Well, you know, what's remarkable to me, Christina, is that there was a Congressional Budget Office report prepared about 3 or 4 years ago that said that it costs 20 to 40% more per child to educate that child if that child does not come equipped with fundamental English language skills when he or she enters school. So think of how cash-strapped so many districts or school districts and cities and states are. The last thing that the school systems need is to be inundated with children who can't speak English. And you know, one of my own personal pet peeves, my youngest son has a form of autism, he has Asperger's, but because of early intervention, he's a success story. He just got a scholarship to engineering school here in New York. I'm super proud of him. We are cutting the funding to early intervention, which we know can have an extreme success rate if it's done early and properly. I mean, this is vital for the future of these children and America. To take a child and give him or her early intervention so that they have not just a reasonable life, but possibly a great life, knowing that without early intervention, they may never be able to stand on their own 2 feet. This is hardly a luxury. This should be common sense. We should all be on the same page on certain issues. And I can't imagine you're going to disagree with me. So
I'm
how
not
going to
disagree
world?
With you. But I don't think any of that $3.5 billion slush fund that the president is asking for, which I understand only includes $25 million for border-related services, I don't think any of it's going to early intervention for American children with disabilities.
So how do we vilify Americans to the point where when you talk about compassion, it becomes a matter of how dare you think that American kids should be treated with compassion?
You know, is the average American saying that? My daughter and I showed up on the footbridge from Baylor University to the city of Waco because that address was advertised nationally. There was no organizer. There was nobody there. It was just us. But people joined us, and one of the people who joined us was a delightful young mother of two, and she said, I don't want this. This is not good for my neighborhood or my children.
Right.
And I think that you know, you can fool some of the people some of the time, but you're not going to fool all the people all the time. And as this goes on and as the schools deal with these problems, I think there could be a political bloodbath in November.
I think it could, and I'd like to see every one of these cement-headed politicians get their comeuppance, as one of my bosses used to refer to it, because of their position of intransigence against their own constituents.
Yep.
That's really where it all comes down to. They are not doing what's essential for their own constituents for this country.
And people say, yeah, you know, Republicans say, well, you know, we have to get through this next election. There is always a next election, so there is always an excuse. And if they won't do the job, people are going to take a chance on the other party.
Well, and why wouldn't they?
Why wouldn't they?
Maybe politicians are insane and figure that they could keep doing the same thing the same way and expect a different outcome. But I think the American people know that that doesn't work. They know that that's
well,
the
and I think there was a lot of, there was a lot of hope that since George Bush had not been very successful, let's give the other party a try. Now that's been historically the way the two-party system has worked. One party gets a little too comfortable, we throw them out and put the other party in.
But is there that much of a difference between the two? They're Republicans.
There hasn't been. There hasn't been, but the only way to make the two-party system work is to regularly, I mean very regularly, throw them out, because the individual politicians want to keep their jobs.
Right. Right. And
so,
you need to
so
make
if the people make it clear
they're
not
going to
tolerate this, you're going to be gone too, and we'll just keep trying different people and different parties until we find people who will do our bidding.
Well, I'm going to ask you a tough question. You ran for office, so maybe you have a different perspective.
But I've run for office three times.
Okay. Unfortunately, the third wasn't the charm. I wish it had been. I think you would have done a good job.
I think Abraham Lincoln might have run more often than that.
I'm sorry?
I think Lincoln may have run more often than that.
Well, maybe you need to get that hat he used to wear.
That's what I need.
That's what you need. There's a fashion accessory. But here's my question, though. How can a congressional representative, be responsive to his or her constituents and to their political party at the same time when very often they're at cross purposes?
Well, you know, Southern Democrats were pretty good at that for a long time.
How so?
Well, they considered themselves Georgia Democrats or South Carolina Democrats, and they were a source of trouble in Washington to their party, because
How cool
the party
is that?
Doesn't elect you. This is not a parliamentary system. You don't have to be nominated by the folks in Washington. You have to be nominated by the folks in your own state or in your own district. So if your district doesn't agree with what the party is doing, you'd better either change parties or get with the people in your district and do what they want.
You know who says the same exact thing, and I love the guy. He's like family to me. I jokingly think of him as my brother from another mother, and that's Lou Barletta from Hazleton. We have these discussions frequently. Oh, yes. And, you know, Lou's history, he was the mayor of Hazleton, Pennsylvania. He went to George Bush's folks. This was during the Bush administration. To his horror, he found that a Dominican drug gang had set up shop in his very bucolic town of Hazleton, Pennsylvania, in the mountains. I mean, beautiful, beautiful place to be. And suddenly this violent gang set up shop in his town. They were selling drugs in the playground. One of the men in the community went up to these guys, and they said, listen, you know, I grew up in this town. I used to play in that playground. My little kids are now playing there. My children are playing there. Take the drugs and go away. We don't want you here with that poison. And the guy pulled out a gun, shot him in the face, and killed him on the spot. So when he went to the administration, they said, well, go talk to immigration. So he went to DHS. He went to Justice. They gave him a mug with a badge in it. If you go to the website, michaelcutler.net, I think CAPS still has it up, capsweb.org, they gave him a mug with a badge on it. And they told him, Mayor, we appreciate your concerns. We feel your pain. But don't expect us to help you. You're on your own, but have a nice mug. So he enacted his own immigration ordinances. He was the first mayor in America to do it. Not surprisingly, he was immediately sued. I was his final witness at the trial. That's how I know Lou. He's now a member of Congress. He sits on the Homeland Security Committee. In fact,
I'm telling you, it's a position that will resonate with people.
Well, you know what's interesting? He told the story in that interview, and he said this little old lady was standing in his parking space in front of City Hall. And he got out of the car and said, you got to move. I'm trying to park my car. She said, I'm not moving. He said, what do you mean you're not moving? You're in my space. She said, I know I'm in your space. I can't be on my front porch without being fearful of getting shot, and you can't park your car in your space. You got to love this feisty old lady, whoever she was. And that was when he went to Washington. So I tried to reach him last week, and I've been tied up. I was just in California a couple of weeks ago doing a speaking event. And by the way, if any of you folks are familiar with speaking opportunities, you can reach me through michaelcutler.net and let me know what the deal is, because I'm happy to go around the country. This is the antidote for mainstream media not being willing to talk about the topics. And by the way, I've also become a columnist for Front Page Magazine. I also have an article coming out this Sunday on American Currency Magazine. Of course, that great magazine founded by Dr. Ben Carson, the executive editor is Armstrong Williams. And I went a little afield. Armstrong asked me to write about the Middle East and Israel. I hope you guys like the article. If I remember the title correctly, it was something to the effect of Middle East Crisis, the Blood-Drenched Chessboard. So interesting article. But, you know, getting back to the matter at hand, Lou got back to me. You know how hard it is to get hold of members of Congress. Lou knew I was trying to reach out to him. He called me up last Saturday morning and said, "Mike, I'm sorry it's been difficult to getting a hold of me. I've been very tied up." And we had a long conversation. And anytime I speak to Lou, what's remarkable, I always joke with him about how he must be angering, you know, pissing off, if you will, the Republican leadership. And he has a very succinct answer. He said the Republican leadership didn't send me to Washington.
No, they did not.
My neighbors did. My neighbors did. And he said, "I know who I represent." And I've heard this a similar sentiment clearly articulated by my friend Steve King from Iowa. And they know who sent them to Washington. You know, Mark Twain had a wonderful statement, I believe it was Twain, who said that we no sooner send these folks to Washington than they forget who sent them and with what purpose. How spot on is that statement?
That's right. Well, this is what I think about Republicans. I think that whereas
and you are
the Democrats,
a Republican, I have to warn my audience, you are a Republican. So
I am a Republican. I only voted for one Democrat in my life, and he was a colleague of mine at the University of Alabama. His father was a senator, and his father was a conservative Southern Democrat, and so was my friend. And the guy running as a Republican was not up to the job. So that was my one vote.
Am I allowed
for
to ask who
a Democrat?
That you
and you know,
for?
As a result of that one vote in a Democrat primary, I got to vote in the 1986 Alabama runoff, which resulted in the Democrat Party of Alabama throwing out their winner and certifying the guy who came in number two, causing the people of Alabama to say, "Isn't there another party? This party is corrupt." And somebody nobody had ever heard of went from $10,000 in the bank to $1 million in a week, and was the first Republican to be elected in Alabama in over 100 years, which just shows you how people can react if, you know, if they can just get the information.
And that's what this is about, you know. When they use the polite term of low information voters. How about dopey voters?
Well, this is a country that is where how many people have cell phones?
Yep.
And how many people have televisions? And how many people have radios? It's not just the voters' fault. It's also the media's fault.
Oh, I agree. And as I said, that's why I do what I'm doing. Am I allowed to ask who the candidate was? You've really got me intrigued now, I have to tell you, Christina.
In Alabama?
Yeah. The Democrats.
Well, I can remember the Democrats because they were public figures. The Democrats were, at that time, the lieutenant governor. His name was, his wife now is very active in politics. I think they got divorced, and she became quite successful. Charlie Bradley Bailey, something like that.
Okay.
He was the choice of the Democrats for governor. The attorney general's name was Charlie Graddick, and Charlie Graddick was a take no prisoners kind of attorney general, who I think at one time he said that not only did he love the death penalty for horrible murderers and rapists, but that he wouldn't mind dancing on their graves after they're executed.
Yeah.
And the Republicans all supported him, and they openly supported him. And then they did something very, very stupid. I know it comes as a shock, Republicans doing something stupid.
Hard to imagine.
They went on television the night of the election, and they said, "He couldn't have won without our support. If we hadn't supported Charlie Graddick, he would have lost." And the Democrats said, "That's true, and we're going to fix that." and they refused to certify him as the winner of their primary. Now, Republicans voting in Democratic primaries in the South was de rigueur. There was only one primary that had, you know, had anything going on, just like the now the Democrats in the Republican primaries in the South. The South apparently can only handle one, you know, real political party at a time. But Charlie Graddick lost. He won, but he lost. And the Republican was such a nothing from Holly Springs, Alabama. I don't know if he was corrupt or if it just made the Democrats so mad they found some way to find corruption. But he really wasn't ready for the governorship.
Not ready for prime time player.
He didn't expect to be governor, but suddenly he was governor, and he was impeached.
Oh, no.
And the lieutenant governor, a Democrat, took over.
Soon to be a major motion picture coming to a theater near
you. Isn't that just terrific? And there were other things going on, like the attorney general wrote letters to the registrars, basically threatening them not to let, I don't know what it was he said. There, you know, but it was
that's
since he was running
swamp,
for office, it was inappropriate for him to be participating politically in telling the registrars what to do. He had a, you know, he was not a disinterested attorney general at that point. And of course, I voted for him. He was no, I didn't vote for him because I was voting in the Democrat primary for my friend.
There you go. How do you deal
I didn't participate
swamp?
In that.
How do you deal with a swamp?
I was teaching American government, and I was just pinching myself that I was getting to teach American government. It's such an exciting time, and I actually had a student in my class who was the assistant press secretary on that campaign. And
oh
she would
God.
Hide in the back of the class and never say anything. But after 300s on tests, I walked to the back of the room and found her and asked her to stay after class, and she said, "I'm trying to keep a low profile. They want to interview me about the election." And they staked her mom's house on Mother's Day, and they got her. And she was called in, and this is what happened. So they've got a commission investigating this election. And they say to her, "So, ma'am, let's see, where were you on such and such a date?" And she said where she was. And then they said, "So you were in this hotel room alone with all these men. What were you doing there?"
Oh, my God.
And she said, "Well, it was a room kind of like this one." And they asked, and she looks around, and there's nothing but men in the room. "Yes, very like this one. They asked me to come, and I came." But she never – we lose a lot of good people when their first experience in politics is something like that.
Yeah. Well, and so, you know, people have to ask themselves, why are they doing this to themselves or their families? I was with Herman Cain.
It's gotten so ugly that truly, I truly do that. I do think, oh, my gosh, you know, I really thought he loved his wife and he loved his children. I got into politics sort of in the back door. I was appointed to a position, and then I was attacked by both the Democrats and the Republicans who were, you know, they were mad at each other. I hadn't done anything wrong, but I was driven out of my job after 3 days, and my name and picture was on the front page of all the newspapers in the country, and I was on every television station, and I figured that running for office could only help my reputation.
Well, you know, I was with Herman Cain a week after he was forced
As
to drop out of the race.
Similar to what happened to Herman Cain, only I wasn't accused of moral turpitude, but it was a kind of, because I was accused of racism, sexism, you know, what else is there, and anti-Semitism.
Right. Well, I remember we talked about that when I met you at the Tea Party convention a couple of years back. But the funny thing about Kane, when I was with him, he was a very, very pleasant guy. I was surprised he knew who I was. I walked in, and he said, "You're the immigration guy, aren't you?" And I thought, well, that's pretty good. If the guy who's running for president knows who I am, I guess the message is getting out there.
Yes,
and
congratulations.
And so we're sitting there chatting, and he insisted I call him Herman. And I said, "Herman, I got to tell you something." And he was there with some of the people that were still hanging on after the campaign with him. He had his little entourage with him. And I said to him, and I got a very big laugh out of him, by the way, I said, "You know, I think your experience with what has happened in the last week gives some real credibility to a theory that I have." He said, "Well, Mike, what's your theory?" I said, "Anybody seeking high political office in America in this environment is demonstrating serious mental illness." And I will tell you that he and the folks there with him couldn't stop laughing.
Well, it's really sad, and Republicans have never wanted their children to go into politics anyway. They look on it as a lesser life, while Democrats, wealthy, well-educated Democrats, look on it as public service and something that they want their children to do. So it's not surprising that you get sort of a lesser caliber of people in the Republican Party. I'm sorry to say that, but...
And, you know, the Democrats
true.
Have become very good, forgive me for saying this, at servicing their voters, don't they, haven't they?
Well,
I mean, it's just disgusting, and it upsets me.
Yeah, no, it's a very sad fact of our political life. But I think they have to, because people have no other idea of what politics is for.
Don't you think JFK in his day did a good job of elevating this idea about national service, whether it's as a civil servant or in politics?
But he was talking to a population that fought World War II.
Right, the greatest generation.
The children of people who fought World War II. The
yep.
World War I people were still around.
Yep.
People were taught patriotism in the schools,
yep.
But beginning with my generation,
mm-hmm.
the ones who went to college, I remember my and I was in a conservative college. My textbook said that politics is the allocation of resources to competing groups.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
so if that's what you think it is, and that's what you think it's about, then you're going to vote for the person who's going to allocate the most to you. If you're not taught that there are some higher purposes and there are some bigger stakes than you getting your stuff, then you're going to have the kind of political
system
that we have now.
They sound like waiters in a diner, don't they? They sound like waiters
yeah.
in a diner. We're here to divide the pie up for you.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
to go back to that analogy, and I always like to say this, that as voters, we need to be as determined to be clear about what we want to order as we would if we were in that restaurant. I've never seen anybody walk into a restaurant and say, "Just throw some crap on the plate, I'll eat it." We're generally very specific about what we want and the way we want it to be prepared. And we need to learn to be just as specific in dealing with our elected representatives. What do you think of that theory?
Yeah, you and I, Mike, are in agreement, and we're not quitters, but a lot of people are. A lot of people just throw up their hands and they say, "There's nothing we can do." And, of course, the people who are, chowing down at the trough and getting the top pieces of meat, they're perfectly happy for you to give up and be glad to get the scraps under the table.
Well, I'm not going anywhere. I mean, someone's got to take these knuckleheads on. I decided it was me on 9/11. My outrage, I have to tell you, and we've talked about this off the air, but my outrage, I had done my first congressional hearing on May 20th, 1997, about visa fraud, immigration benefit fraud. So to have testified about those issues in the context of national security and then witness 9/11 up close, where the ashes landed on us, where the stench permeated the air we breathed for 6 months, to see my neighbors sitting on the sidewalk in front of my house that night screaming and shrieking. They didn't know where their wives or their parents, their children, or their siblings were. I'll tell you, I'm not the same. I don't think anybody who was in New York that night is the same. To see my neighbors come home covered in ashes, greeted by crying family members, like, thank God you made it, and the ones whose family members didn't come home slowly coming to the realization they were never going to see them again, and knowing in my heart of hearts that if they had listened to that hearing, if they had taken the advice, they, the Clinton administration, but of course what difference does it make, that 9/11 not only wouldn't have happened but couldn't have happened, and now to witness stupidity on a galactic scale. I mean, this is the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 Commission report. Governor Kaine went before the Homeland Security Committee. Lou Barletta, my friend, had asked him a question that was very important. There's another question that I would have preferred to have asked, but Lou did okay. And he asked him about this notion of using biometrics to track the comings and goings of foreign nationals. In fact, that was one of the recommendations I made during that hearing I had done 4.5 years before 9/11. But the one question that I wished had been asked, and I'm going to go back and look at the transcript, and I don't blame Lou. I mean, it's so hard to get a question into these hearings. Having done all these hearings, I know how tough it is, and he does a great job representing all Americans. But someone needs to ask, how in the world does the way that we give out visas and expand the visa waiver program and provide illegal aliens with lawful status without the capacity to interview them, let alone investigate their applications, how does that square with the findings of the 9/11 Commission? And we know the answer. It imperils our safety. It imperils national security, and nobody is willing to even raise the issue. And when you try to raise the issue, you would think that you're talking about some god-awful topic. This is about the survival of our country. And if you don't secure the borders, and you don't even have justification for a military, because the military's primary mission is to keep a country's enemies as far from their shores as possible. How can the military protect the country when potentially millions of foreign nationals determined to end your country are present within the borders of your country?
Well, we let the bad guys across the border, and we keep the border patrol 30 miles inland.
I mean, and then when you get past them, wherever they are, there's no second tier. This is like trying to play baseball without your outfielders taking to the field when you're supposed to be playing defense. So anybody who hits the ball over the infielder's head gets an in-the-park home run. How's that for an image?
Yeah, that's a good image. That says it. That pretty much says it.
And so people need to understand this isn't about xenophobia or racism. This isn't about a lack of compassion. This is about a lack of common sense and morality. You know,
yeah.
When we're on airplanes, they tell us that if the oxygen comes down, put yours on before you help anyone. America needs the oxygen, and we're trying to starve America from its source of oxygen. None of this
makes
any
sense. That's right, because if you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of anybody else.
That's right. So how in the world are we living up to any of these obvious common sense obligations? You know what I would like to know, Christina? Here's an interesting question for you. How many immigration lawyers are in Congress on both sides of the aisle who, when they look at those illegal aliens coming our way, this is kind of a Rorschach, you know? As an agent, I worry about criminals, terrorists,
Mike,
drug traffickers.
Mike, you need to run for Congress. I don't think there are any.
They see clientele. They see clientele for themselves and their buddies. How's that for an interesting observation?
Oh, dear. But I don't think there are. Are there any immigration lawyers in Congress?
There absolutely are, and one of them is a Republican that I had a meeting with. And during the conversation, he told me that he knew more about immigration than I did because he's an immigration lawyer. And my response was to tell him that I would gladly put my 30 years of experience as an inspector, adjudicator, and agent. I was an agent for 26 years. I said, no disrespect intended, but I'll put my 30 years of experience against your experience as an attorney any day of the week, and as my dad might have said, twice on Sunday. And this guy's ears were glowing bright red.
Oh, gee. So I guess he didn't agree with you on the issues.
Not even close. And when I asked this individual why the 9/11 Commission report wasn't the starting point for any conversation on immigration, you would have thought I was asking him about his sex life or something. He was steadfast in not wanting to answer the question. What I kept getting were answers to the effect of the American people don't have the stomach to deport 11 million. I said it's probably closer to 30 or 40 million, but I said I'm going to tell you something else they don't have the stomach for and probably less stomach for. and that's another 9/11 or, God forbid, an attack of far worse consequences.
Well, you know, maybe we just need a little bit more imagination. I have a friend named Walter McSherry, whom, if you come to Spartanburg, South Carolina, you will surely meet. Walter is in his 80s, but he used to live in Manhattan, and used to give some folks some fits in Manhattan. But he worked on Wall Street doing something computer related. Uh-huh. And when New York City got the big bailout, he was quite disgusted because he's a fiscally conservative and socially conservative Republican. So he noticed that the man from his town, his area of Oklahoma, had voted for the bailout. So he wrote a couple of letters to the local newspaper thanking this congressman publicly for helping to lower his taxes. And he had figured out how much every American was going to pay, and so he figured out how much the 550,000 people in that Oklahoma district would actually be pouring in to the benefit of the city of New York. And that guy lost in the next election.
Well, that's funny.
So I'm suggesting maybe you need to be writing letters to the district of that immigration attorney / congressman. I know it could be bad for immigration because then he'd go back to getting people, the few people that get deported, he'd be trying to keep them from getting deported. But still, it'd be better than having him in Congress.
Well, you know, and people really need to understand exactly what that perspective looks like to these folks. I mean, this is really remarkable. You know, there's so many potential ways that there can be conflicts of interest here and short-sightedness here, and people with grammatic challenges who can only conjugate verbs in the first person singular. I don't know a nicer way of saying it.
That's a very nice way of saying it.
Doesn't it work?
And, you know they probably don't know what the word conjugate means, and so they don't realize that it's an insult. So,
probably so.
No, our education is in a terrible mess, and it's responsible. It's really the most basic cause of the problems that we have going, because Mr. Obama, for all of his audacity, couldn't get away with any of this stuff if there was an educated electorate.
No, I agree, and that's true for all these politicians. And, you know, it's time that Americans stop looking at that party line nonsense when they go into a voting booth. I'm tired of people on both sides of the aisle saying, well, you know, it's the Republicans, it's the Democrats, it's the progressives. That's name-calling. Look at individual candidates, and I'll leave you with a thought that we need to talk off the air this evening if you have a couple of minutes. But here's a parting thought for all of you, and I got to tell you, I'm so delighted that you called.
I'll hold on because I can't get you on the radio.
Say again?
I said when you're through talking to me on the radio, I'll hold on so I can hear the rest of your show, and then I'll talk to you afterwards if you have time.
Okay, yes, I will. I will definitely call you. But I just want you to know how delightful it was to have you on. I've been wanting to invite you to be a guest on my show for the longest time. I guess you were reading my mind this evening.
I just barged in.
You did, but that's fine. I'm glad you barged. I'll call you
my
on the
pleasure.
Number I'll call you on the number you called me on, right, from the phone.
If you can do that, that would be wonderful. But if you leave me on, I'll be able to hear you because my computer is not picking up your show.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah, no, I will. And then when I get off, I'll call you is what I'm saying. So what I wanted to say, though, is that your perspectives coupled with Mark Hager's perspectives, both of you professors, both of you looking at things from an intellectual, learned perspective, is so important. The American people have allowed themselves to be dumbed down. And what I find so frustrating, I was having a conversation with a lady who was very conservative, and she started ranting and raving at me at how the school has dumbed down her children. And I said to her, you're a conservative. She said, I am. I said, you know, our kids should be made to read 1984, and they're not. And she said, well, what in the world can we do about it? I said, well, you mean you can't go to your kids and say, you will read it? I said, I have four children. None of them was supposed to have to read 1984. And when they got to class, they didn't. But when they came through my front door of my house, they did. I said, I thought that most conservatives are ranting and raving about getting government off our back and let us do what we have to do. I said, ma'am, all due respect to you, what you need to have to do is to start being a more effective parent.
Yep.
Have I lost my mind?
No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And,
I mean, if you
and,
don't think the school
one of the problems, one of the problems with the schools today is they don't really want the parents interfering. And so the parents are happy to not interfere. You just let us take care of it. We're the experts. You just go right on and, you know, you just go on with your life. And parents get where they don't even want children to have homework because, you know, they have bought this, you know, it's the job of the schools to educate their children.
Well, you know, it's so remarkable.
It's the job of maybe it's society's job to educate children, but the first teachers are the parents. And if the parents aren't interested in education, the children are not going to be interested in education.
No, and what's so remarkable, when we were trying to get my son into a proper school because of the fact he was autistic, and, you know, my degree was in communications. I took some speech therapy classes. I'm not a speech therapist. I don't even play one on TV, but I'm certainly not a total layman either. I studied autism as part of the curriculum. Obviously, lots more has been learned in the 40-odd years since I stepped out of that classroom. But the point is, as a parent and as somebody who's reasonably well-educated, and I was the Parents Association president of my daughter's public school where I was with lots of children my son's age at that time, I wasn't coming into this as some guy who just crawled out from under a stone somewhere. And the immediate thing was, well, we're allowed to say this. We're allowed to do that, but your parents, you're not allowed to do any of that. You know, when I started talking about milestones in development, they said, oh, well, you know, you're not allowed to make comparisons. That's dangerous. And I said, well, how about the school that says that a child is reading below math level or reading below grade level or doing English above grade level? Isn't that a comparison? Well, we're the experts. We're the professionals. We're allowed to do that. You're not. Well, if you really believe that the parent has no role in educating a child, then why in the world are we having children? We have a very serious responsibility. And if I hear one more parent tell me that they want to be their 12-year-old's best friend, I'm going to have a total meltdown.
They've got lots of options for best friends, and they have very few options for parents.
Absolutely. And if you think that your job is to be the best friend to a 12-year-old or you want to be the best friend to a 12-year-old, number one, you need counseling, and number two, you need to get a life.
Yeah, and the poor kids.
And the poor kids. I mean, imagine what the damage that does. And mm-hmm. So I find this so remarkable.
People will accept that they don't have responsibility very readily. Oh, it's not my responsibility? Oh, that's great. I'm quite happy to hear that.
One less thing on my to-do list.
That's right. And if everybody's getting that message and you know, everybody, you've got plenty of support for that attitude, you're going to have very poorly educated kids. And that's what we have now. And we're into many generations of poorly educated people.
Well, you know, it's funny. My parents didn't have much in the way of formal education. My mom came here as a 14-year-old girl, head of the Holocaust, lived in a rooming house by herself, didn't even speak English. She spoke Polish and Yiddish, taught herself English, got herself a job at an umbrella factory for the amazing sum of $3 a week, became the chief buyer for a dress company that was so successful that her boss became one of the dollar-a-year men for Roosevelt and very often credited my mother with much of his success. In her 20s, she was his chief buyer with that fourth-grade education. My dad had an eighth-grade education. He was a tradesman, a plumber. But they instilled in me a love of knowledge, a love of reading, a love of learning. I was just going to say, when I was 5 years old, my mother had convinced me I was going to college. I didn't even know what a college was. But all I knew was by the time I got older, I was going to have to go to one of those places. And in fact, I did. And the saddest thing for me, of course, was that my parents had both passed away before I graduated, so they weren't there on graduation day. So it was a very bittersweet day for me. But the,
sounds
the
like
idea,
your mother was the equivalent of Alexander Hamilton, who at 14 was running a trading company in the West Indies.
She could have been. She was brilliant, and she, you know, I hear my parents' advice every day. You know, my mom used to say to me, "It's not what you say, it's how you say it." She said, "You could tell somebody that, you know, they should go to hell, and they'll kiss you, and tell them you love them, and they'll want to take a crowbar to your skull." She said, "It's how you explain things. It's how you say things." I mean, such amazing wisdom, such amazing insight. You know, I tell people I stand on their shoulders every day. I'm sorry?
My Southern grandmother used to say, Southern charm is being able to tell somebody to go to hell and have him look forward to the trip.
Very good. Very good, Christina. Well, I'm going to wrap up my program, and then I'm going to get back with you. But, I want to tell you that it was really a joy. We have to get you back on the program. It's always a delight to share your perspectives, your extensive experiences and background. And hopefully, as a result, my audience is a bit more well-informed and has a brand-new perspective on such important issues that you bring with you to the discussion.
I'm just a Mike Cutler follower, because I do think that you are dealing with one of the key issues facing America today. And even though I said there are all these things are related, we have to tackle them one at a time, because they are causing problems one at a time.
Yeah, it's a game of whack-a-mole, and we've got to hammer these in real solidly. And you know, ever since 9/11, I've been a man on a mission. Because I realize the true importance of immigration. I realize the level of the mythology that's being spewed by people who are literally and figuratively making out like bandits.
And you also realize that the government can know the truth. It can articulate the truth. They can write down the truth, and they can go right on and act as though the truth is not the truth.
Yep, and you have politicians who take the position of don't confuse me with the facts. But as I think it was John Adams said, facts are stubborn things, didn't he?
Yes, they are. Well, I'm going to, since you're wrapping up, I'll go ahead and hang up, and I will look forward to your call.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your hosting and your hospitality. Bye-bye.
Okay. Have a great weekend. Well, that was Christina Jeffries, college professor from South Carolina, and Mark Hager, professor from North Carolina, history professor as well. You know, my goal on this program, as I've said repeatedly tonight, is to provide the perspectives, the vital information, the insight that you're not going to get from the mainstream media. I don't have a sponsor. I don't make money doing this program. And even if I did, you know, I have a strong moral compass, thanks to my wonderful parents who died when I was in college. They taught me right from wrong. Unfortunately, that's not too prevalent, it seems, these days. The purpose of this program is to provide these perspectives, not about Democrat or Republican, not about left, not about right, but about right or wrong. If we can't secure our borders and enforce our immigration laws, we are in deep trouble. We live in a perilous era, perilous time, and we have to have the truth, and we, the people, have to make our government accountable. At the end of the day, this is our responsibility. This is the job Americans must do. So with the information that we provide on the program, I hope I can help to make those of you out there more aware of the issues, so you can make your elected representatives, so-called, truly represent you and America. Because at the end of the day, that's what their oaths of office are supposed to be about. I want to thank all of you for spending this Friday, July 25th, 2014, with me, with my guests, Christina Jeffrey, Mark Hager. I look forward to joining you again next week at the same time. As I said a little bit earlier, you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. Make certain that we let our elected representatives know what we expect of them and make them accountable. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. See you next week.